Welcome to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program.
And aloha, America. Welcome to our show today. It is Friday, January 7th, 2011. Thank goodness it's Friday. Thank goodness it's Friday. And boy, we got a lot of stuff to talk about. There's a lot of crazy stuff going on around the world. Probably the biggest story right now, although you wouldn't know it if you're watching the corporate media because they're barely even mentioning it right now, the Massachusetts State Supreme Court has reached a decision in this foreclosure case that is considered to probably be setting a precedent for the rest of the entire nation. U.S. Bancorp and Wells Fargo lost this case at the highest court. Basically, the court upheld a judge's decision saying that two foreclosures were invalid because the banks could not prove they owned the mortgages, because they were improperly transferred into two of these mortgage-backed trusts. Now, the real issue was here, as a matter of fact, perfect timing. Joining us on the phone right now is Tracy Long. Tracy, as you know, is an attorney specializing in foreclosures. We've been trading emails about this all day long. So, Tracy, aloha. Welcome to the show. Thank you for being able to spend time with us today. I'm not hearing Tracy.
My pleasure.
There we are. We're hearing you now. Basically, I'm trying to bring our audience up to speed on this. Basically, the issue is the law in Massachusetts, and I believe that this is true for pretty much the rest of the country, requires that two documents be in possession for a foreclosure action. You can sue under the bank note, the loan note, but in order to foreclose, you must have the title or the mortgage itself. And in this case, the banks were transferring these mortgages into these mortgage-backed trusts. It was done through this mortgage electronic registration system. The banks tried to sort of create the paperwork after the fact to make it all look legal. This is what we call the foreclosure mills or the fraud closures situation, and the judge said, no, that's not good enough. At the time you filed the foreclosures, they were not legal to do, and therefore they're null and void. And this is, causing quite a few ripples throughout the mortgage industry. And I know this only broke a couple of hours ago, and the details are still coming in. But what is your view of what's going on in the Massachusetts court right now?
Well, I'll tell you, Mike, I've been following the Ibanez case, and that's what it is, for quite some time now. And a higher court ruling in favor of the homeowners is nothing short of a breakthrough for the homeowners. I mean, this could really push back the banks. You know, you mentioned a couple of concepts in your colloquy there that I think need to be clarified for the benefit of the listener. There's two different parts of an underlying loan. There is the promissory note and there is the mortgage. Okay, the promissory note is what's called a negotiable instrument. It's best to think of that as a check. That's one writes to the other. That's what's negotiable. The mortgage is what's called a security interest. That gives whoever holds the mortgage the right to enforce the note. So if you have the two become separated, that means the person holding the mortgage can't enforce the note. That's one of the things that we in the business try to show is the separation of the note and mortgage, because the end result of that is a note sitting there, you know, in its bare form, and all the homeowner has to do is just declare bankruptcy and can completely wipe out the note, leaving the bank with nothing or pennies on the dollar.
Okay, well, that is a very, very important concept, that once the note and the mortgage become separated, foreclosure becomes invalid. And apparently this was the reason for all of these foreclosure mills and all these offices that set up where they're using phony signatures and phony notary stamps and all the rest of this to try and fabricate, create, and some say forge documents to make it look like the mortgages and the notes were still linked together. Tracy, we got to take a break for some commercials. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Join us on the air, 800-313-9443.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
What this country is coming to, I sure would like to know. If they don't do something, by and by, the rich will live and the poor will die. Doggone, I mean the panic is on.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to our show. We're talking about this breakthrough legal decision that has just been handed down this morning from the Massachusetts State Supreme Court, upholding a lower court decision that because banks were unable to prove that they had both the note and the mortgage in their possession at the time they filed for foreclosure, that the foreclosures are null and void. And efforts to fabricate the paperwork after the fact are completely invalid. And the corporate media is barely mentioning this. Bloomberg is spinning it as, oh, it's just a paperwork hassle and nothing to pay attention to. But it did have an immediate effect. The stock in both of these banks took an immediate hit. NASDAQ is down quite a bit because of this. The ramifications of this decision are still filtering out and being felt by the financial industry. But the issue is that this rush to foreclose on people's homes, this desperate grab for real assets to recapitalize the bank balance sheets after the forced repurchasing of all these fraudulent mortgage-backed securities, is going to come to a screeching halt at this point, because we now have a state Supreme Court decision that sets a legal precedent that all of these fraud closures are not legally binding. Now, exactly where this is going to go, we're not sure. Tracy, my guess is probably the banks are simply going to refile the foreclosures and say, okay, well, we've got the paperwork correct now, and they'll move forward. There are other people saying that this may put the banks into immediate insolvency. I don't think so. The banks will simply go to the U.S. government and ask for more taxpayer bailouts. One way or the other, the losses still get dropped on the American people. But what do you think is going to be the fallout from this morning's decision?
Well, I have to give you a little bit of a framework so you can understand the real importance of this. The bottom line, one of the subtexts from the opinion was that the mortgage does not necessarily follow the note. That's the same separation issue, and you see that argument presented by attorneys for the banks in court all the time. They don't have a valid assignment of the mortgage from one entity to the next. And because there's a note that's what's called endorsed in blank, they said just because they hold a note, the mortgage follows the note. The underlying Ibanez opinion completely repudiated that train of thought, and it appears to have been upheld by the upper court. So, therefore, it allows the separation of note and mortgage and gives the homeowner an argument. Now, as far as the background, you have to understand these mortgage-backed securities are what's called REMICs. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, Mike.
I've heard the word. I don't know exactly what it means.
REMIC is a trust that has been authorized under the IRS rules and regulations, and it allows them to pool mortgages into an asset pool and sell to investors. Mm-hmm. And under the rules, they are exempt from IRS taxation as long as all the mortgages are in the asset pool on day one of the trust, when the trust comes into existence. Because the rules are so strict, the trust issues what's called a pooling and servicing agreement with a prospectus. Now, the pooling and servicing agreement has two important dates in there. One is called the cutoff date, and the other one's called the closing date. Cutoff date is the date in which all mortgages which are going to go into the asset pool need to be identified by name, number, lender, specific information. The closing date is the date in which all mortgages and notes are to be into the asset pool, into the mortgage file, along with chain of title. If it's a note, it has to be endorsed in blank. If it's a mortgage, it has to be assignment. If it's coming from MERS, it has to be. The bottom line is, it has to be in on day one of the trust existence. Because if it is not and it's transferred in later, it completely voids the REMIC, and it's subject to 100% taxation by the IRS. That's why the rules are so strict.
Okay.
What you're finding in these foreclosure actions is they didn't do the paperwork, they didn't do the necessary transfers. So when a homeowner defaults, now they have to start backdating things and making it look like there was a transfer and when there's not. This ruling from the Massachusetts Supreme Court completely, outlines and puts a really fine point on that process and what should have been done and what wasn't done here. There's a lot of cases across the United States that fall into this category, and there has never been a ruling on the record of this magnitude that allows attorneys like me to piece it together and go before the judge and get a specific ruling. Up until now, you go in front of the judge, and they'll just say, well, there's nothing on the record. There's no issue of law on this yet. Now we have something.
Well, that is indeed major, and I was unaware of the IRS rules regarding the REMIC. One other implication I wanted to talk about, there's a parallel article going on about this. Apparently, Chase Bank is being sued by Deutsche Bank to force them to repurchase a whole bunch of these mortgage-backed securities, that's really the heart of this entire economic destruction of the United States of America. In my opinion, Osama bin Laden could not even dream of doing as much damage to America as the mortgage-backed securities did. So apparently Chase now has filed a motion regarding this litigation against Deutsche Bank, stating that it did not acquire mortgage loans or liabilities in connection with its acquisition of Washington Mutual, because the acquisition from Washington Mutual is not yet legally completed. Now, apparently some lawyers are seizing on this, saying that if we accept Chase's declaration in this motion, then Chase has been committing massive fraud because they have already filed for foreclosure on a lot of these assets that they acquired from this Washington Mutual situation. So this is just turning into be this incredibly complicated nest of interlocked cause and effect. And it seems like in a lot of cases that the whole process was so complicated that nobody really was able to keep an eye on what all of it really meant.
Correct.
And I know a lot of people say that in this obfuscation is how the fraud was intended to be concealed. But now it's really starting to unravel. And apparently, I mean, I know Bank of America got a get-out-of-jail-free card from the U.S. government and from all 50 state attorney generals in exchange for a settlement. In other words, Bank of America stole the dollar, and they're going to give the state governments a quarter to get off the hook, and everybody says, oh, that's fine, that's how justice is served. But that does not protect them from all the civil litigations that are coming up, the class action lawsuits, and certainly the U.S. government has no influence over all of these foreign banks, like Deutsche Bank, who are coming in to sue the American financial system for this thing. I don't know where this is going to go. I think the only thing we can absolutely guarantee is that the U.S. government and the banks are going to try and find some way to drop all of this on the American taxpayer, because that's been the history up to this point. Tracy, if you don't mind, we've actually got a couple of callers on the line who'd like to ask you some questions about what's going on. So we're going to go to Jim in Missouri. Aloha, Jim. Welcome to the show. What would you like to ask Tracy? Is Jim there?
Hello,
Jim, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, do you have a question for our guest, Tracy Long?
Well, what I'd like to do is just to present to you what I actually went through, and I found this conversation very interesting because I dealt with Wells Fargo. I got a notice of foreclosure in October. I'm not going to say the year. I went to the United States District Court to file an injunction to stop them. And I did that. And then in the process of doing that, I think it wasn't until January following that in my USDC case, all of a sudden, they come up with an assignment.
We've been seeing a lot of that, yeah.
And the assignment, allegedly, was done in November. But interesting enough, all of a sudden, I get this 1099A. This is kind of a complicated issue, but I'm in USDC filing for an injunction, And then on December 3rd, Wells Fargo files an unlawful detainer. We're a non-judicial state.
Jim, we kind of need to sort of get down to the point here so that Tracy's got something to respond to, and
okay,
I'm not
okay.
sure. But yeah, we need a question that we can respond to.
Oh, that's what I'm getting to. What I received a 1099A. It came from Wells Fargo, but the 1099A was from Federal National Mortgage, which is Fannie Mae, and it said that they acquired my property on December 1st. On December 3rd, Wells Fargo Bank filed an unlawful detainer on me to take my property away from me. But they were not the lender. Federal National Mortgage was, which is Fannie Mae.
Okay.
What do you do?
Tracy?
If I were you, I would immediately move to dismiss, because what you have here is... the right hand does not know what the left hand is doing. The people in the bank buy and sell these mortgages just like a street vendor. And at some point in time, they assign a defaulted mortgage off to an attorney to sue, and they don't update them what's going on. So there's the problem, and you have to bring that to the court's attention.
Tracy, got to take a break. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Some are maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, just scratch yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show. And Tracy, let me see if I can sort of back up and simplify what seems to be emerging from this whole situation. In order, in the good old days where you went to the bank, you got a mortgage, you paid off the mortgage, and you got your title back, the mortgage itself and the promissory note were sort of treated as a unit. They sort of had to go through the system together. Under the current mortgage-backed security mess, and certainly amplified by the mortgage electronic registration system, which seems to be a major villain in all of this, Okay, I'm not sure why we're getting. Okay, all right, we're gone now. Okay, so the mortgage and the note get separated, and they're not coordinating what's happening to either of these two as it works through the process. And that's why we're getting these situations where people are being foreclosed on, even though their mortgage is up to date. We know there have been some horrible mistakes where people are being foreclosed on who don't even have a mortgage. And this is not even getting into the area of the efforts to sort of fulfill the missing paperwork with outright fraud. And there's a rather interesting PowerPoint presentation that came out of the Florida Attorney General, which he's literally showing how the same names of these legal executives were being forged and ad infinitum on these documents. We know that there was an attempt to pass the Iron Bill last year, where a simple notary seal was going to be considered legal proof of the legitimacy and validity of a document in order to try and end run around this necessity of proving that you actually had the note and mortgage. That failed, thankfully. I think what is coming down right now, I think most people are probably waiting on Wall Street and in America itself. Main Street and Wall Street are wondering how the federal government plans to resolve this mess, because it looks to me like it is such a complicated screw-up. There is no easy solution. I'm almost reminded of this Tom Clancy book, The Sum of All Fears, where the bad guys intentionally screw up Wall Street. They put it into a crash, and then they sabotage all the computers so all the records are messed up. And the only solution ultimately is to say, okay, let's go back to the point where we had good solid records on everything and say we're starting over from there. And it almost feels like the only way out of this current mess is to simply go back to just before the mortgage electronic registration system and all this mortgage-backed security stuff came into existence and say, okay, whoever had the houses then, you're back in them, and you're back to where you were at those mortgage payments, and just sort of erase that whole financial disaster of mortgage-backed securities. Unfortunately, I know the foreign banks won't go along with that, but it almost seems like the federal government, and this goes back to that statement that was made by Damon Silvers, I think his name was, during the congressional hearings, we can either deal reasonably with the foreclosure mess, or we can preserve the capital structure of the banks. We cannot do both. And I think most Americans are worried right now that the government has decided that they've got to protect the banks no matter how much it hurts the American people. And if the Massachusetts Supreme Court decision goes to the United States Supreme Court, that the U.S. Supreme Court may reverse. What do you think about that?
Let me back up for a second before I answer the bigger picture and provide some clarity for you. And it really underscores the beauty of the Massachusetts decision, because I mentioned a couple times something called an endorsement in blank. Now, if you go and you think of the note as a check, as I said, a negotiable instrument, an endorsement in blank is simply paid to the order of, and they leave it blank. And it can be anybody. So whoever has bare possession of it, it becomes a bearer note, can basically cash it. That's how the note and the mortgage become separated, because once you have an endorsement in blank, you can pass it around to anyone, and they can go in and cash it or sell it. The important thing is an assignment doesn't work. I mean, the mortgage doesn't work the same way. It has to be specifically assigned from one party to the next. You can't just have a blank assignment. They become separated, and the true beauty of the Massachusetts ruling is that an endorsement in blank is not sufficient to give the banks standing to sue.
Okay, now I understand that. That does clear it up. Thank you very much.
And as far as the larger question, I do think it's coming to a meltdown. The government's going to have to decide one way or another, and my fear is that they'll side against the homeowner in order to preserve the banks. They showed that they have a capacity to do that. The TARP money was paid out, so the precedent is already there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, going back to the savings and loan meltdown of the 1980s, I mean, very clearly the government looted the American people to save the savings and loan associations, and most of the depositors who were not widows and pensioners and orphans, like we were all told in the news, in many cases they were corporate numbered brokered accounts. Some of them were tied in with the CIA's Iran-Contra drug running, and it was just an absolute historic scam perpetrated on the American people. Of course, looking back on that from today, it looks like small potatoes, you know, kind of on the scale of wrapping scotch tape around your fingers backwards and grabbing change out of the collection plate.
The big example is AIG. I mean, it was the biggest insurer in the world and became so big that the American government couldn't let it fail.
Okay, hold on to that thought. We got to take another commercial break. We'll be right back with AIG.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
HempUSA.org today.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Visit us online at whatreallyhappened.com. And now, set your eyes on the future.
Okay.
Let's consider what really happened.
It's that gosh darn hamster in that wire wheel here. All right, well, welcome back to the show. We're talking with Tracy Long. We're talking about foreclosures. We're talking about fraudulent mortgage-backed securities. We're talking about political corruption on an apocalyptic scale. We're talking about AIG. And, Tracy, before I give you back the soapbox, I just want to mention in brief, we're talking about how Congress has been repeatedly voting the people's money into Wall Street to try and prop Wall Street up. And I think the reason is really very simple. Members of Congress are themselves very rich people. Former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi is worth $500 million. And so when, you know, and they've got their money invested in these Wall Street firms. And so obviously when they start looking at these firms hovering on the edge of collapse, it's their own personal money that's at stake. They're going to vote their own wallets. Now, the president of the United States of America is required to put his assets and his wealth into a blind trust so that his own personal financial well-being will not influence his decisions. Now, we know, going back to the Clinton administration, that these trusts are themselves often fraudulent. But I really do think, given how wealthy members of Congress have become, that it's time for that blind trust requirement to apply to all members of the Senate and the House of Representatives. Because clearly, their own financial well-being is what guided their votes to support TARP and all these other bailout programs to the detriment of the American people. And I think that's an idea whose time has definitely come. So anyway, you were talking about AIG and the so-called too big to fail, too big to jail institutions. Can you kind of pick up where you left off?
Yeah, the institution becomes so big that if it is allowed to fall, it pulls the rest of the economy down with it. So the government really has no choice but to prop it up through any means. Usually, unfortunately, that's through the taxpayer, who rarely gets the money back. And I think you have the same problem emerging with these mortgage-backed securities. They're just too big, and they have too much assets in them to allow them to fail. So what I believe personally is going to happen is the government is going to find some sort of shortcut to allow the banks to go around the usual requirements of the law and facilitate these foreclosures. I think it's only a matter of time.
Well, I think they already did it. I think one of the reasons that the U.S. government has never reversed the tax credits encouraging the offshoring of high-paying American jobs is that this is a program of wealth confiscation. Because it doesn't matter what kind of deals all these banks and financial institutions make within the United States of America. The big problem are all the foreign banks and investors like Deutsche Bank and Credit Suisse who bought these mortgage-backed securities. Now they're saying to the U.S. banks, you've got to buy them back because these were frauds. These were fraudulent. And the only way the American banks can stay solvent after buying back all these fraudulent mortgage-backed securities, they need some other asset to go on the balance sheet. And that's why I've been telling my listeners that monthly payment you are making for the next 15 to 20 years is of no use to the bank right now. They need the entire value of your home on their books right now to stay solvent. And so we're looking at a wealth confiscation operation conducted against the American people. Back in 1933, Franklin Roosevelt did it with gold and said, turn in your gold, we'll give you these pretty printed pieces of paper in exchange because we need the gold in order to pay the war debt and try and get out of this last economic mess the Federal Reserve caused. But,
The pooling and servicing agreement comes into play here, again, because one of the provisions of the pooling and servicing agreement is that if the mortgage is not identified and transferred in time, the original lender is supposed to purchase it back. The problem is once the original lender has gotten paid off for the same loan, they have the money in their pocket. They don't want to take it back. They don't want to give the money back. Therein lies the problem. And now you're going to see a sort of cannibalism between the two banks, Deutsche Bank and Chase. It's the perfect example. They're going to eat their own young.
Absolutely. Boy, that was an aspect I was unaware of. And, I can see why this becomes a major problem, because it's not just international European law, but even the pooling and service agreement contract says they have to buy the mortgages back if they were assigned late. Boy, this
right.
really gets to be such a complex nest here. But I think if you're talking about shortcutting the process, the issue is that all of these too big to fail banks and mortgage companies, need to cover the losses from these forced repurchases, and
you're going to come into, and this is where it really gets interesting, because the true beauty of the Massachusetts opinion is you have a judicial ruling about paperwork that is required to move forward and foreclose on these. If the government takes any action, it's going to be that it requires less paperwork to get to the finish line and foreclose on these things. So now you're going to have a judicial ruling versus either an executive fiat or a legislative ruling. You're going to have a pure constitutional issue here.
Well, you know, they were trying to pass that iron bill, you know, a while back, and that failed where, you know, your little magic notary stamp, and I bought this one for the state of Ohio off of eBay, so I guess I can foreclose on the White House. Basically, even if the government or the legislature passes a law saying the paperwork can be shortcut, it can't apply to all the foreclosures already in process or already having been done, because that would be ex post facto.
Correct.
So unless the president is willing to declare, you know, an executive act by fiat saying, we're sorry, but we need your houses to give to the banks to save them from the foreclosure fraud, I think more than a constitutional crisis is at hand here. We've been seeing all across Europe, you know, rioting, Iceland kicked out their government. At some point, I think the American people need to understand a very simple and basic truth. The U.S. government took your jobs to make it easier for the banks to take your homes to save the Wall Street fraudsters from having to go to jail for this whole mortgage-backed security crisis. And it goes back almost 10 years now that they were gaming the system to make themselves fabulously rich, and they were going to dump all the losses on the American people. And I know every time that the Federal Reserve hands out another $1 trillion, they say, oh, don't worry, it's a loan. The people that we're giving this money to, they'll pay it back. Well, one of two things is going to happen. Either the loan defaults, which we've been seeing, and the losses get dropped on the American people, or whatever institution is given the money, they make it back. How? By raising prices on goods and services sold to the people, cutting the quality of the products, cutting the quality of the services, so it still comes out of the American people. All of this huge cash loss that resulted from this wild casino ride that followed the repeal of Glass-Steagall. And, you know, this is a wonderful quote out of Umberto Eco's book, The Name of the Rose. The poor are always made to pay for all. Doesn't matter whether it's a repayment from the institution of the Federal Reserve or a direct taxation. Somehow or other, the boys in Washington, D.C. and Wall Street are going to figure out some way to screw you for the money and make you think it's a really good idea.
That's sad but true.
And, you know, this whole situation, I mean, we've seen it, you know, as the foreclosures were really going. We saw it in all the corporate media about, oh, it's really the fault of those homeowners who bought those homes and took out those mortgages. No, it wasn't, because when they got the mortgages, they could afford the payments. They
That's
were lured
right. I mean,
in.
They were baited into this.
The government dangled an $8,000 first-time homebuyer tax credit to lure more people into the system, because they understood the mortgages were not the bubble. The mortgage-backed securities were the bubble, and everybody was getting rich on this thing. And
here's
then,
a really sad thing, Mike. And that's one end of the problem with how they got into these things in the first place. Now on the other side, I see this literally on a daily basis, sometimes twice, three times a day. But the person who is current on their mortgage is told by their servicer, Do you want to modify this? And of course, who's not going to want to modify the loan and get a lower payment? Well, you have to be in default to be able to modify. So they bait the current person into defaulting on their mortgage. They get a ding on their credit. They start this whole treadmill. At the end of the line, 2 years later, they're denied the modification and
because they're already in foreclosure
sales pending.
Yeah, it's a scam. I mean, this whole mortgage modification program has not helped anybody. It's just a way for the government to look like they're trying to take care of the American people, when the reality is this is a massive wealth confiscation plan done in a way to make the American people think it's their own fault they lost their homes.
And the whole cycle is going to be reset, because it started 20, 30 years ago. The person holding the property, the banks, are now going to ride it back up again as it increases in value, now that they've killed the value of everyone's home.
Yeah, that's it. It's another repeat of the cycle. I mean, we saw the same thing following the crash of 1929, when real estate property values plummeted, the banks grabbed it all, and they started the cycle again. Here you can have a home as long as you promise to work for the bank for the rest of your useful working life. And it's the same thing all over again. And it all goes back to that primary evil, the private central bank, which was never intended for the people of the United States of America. We got sold out by three successive Congresses. And the first two, we had courageous presidents who were able to undo the damage. But with this last one, the private central bank, the Federal Reserve, it's no more federal than Federal Express or Federal Pizza. It's a private company. And it exists to transfer the wealth from the American people into the pockets of the private bankers. And what we are missing in this day and age is a leader with the moral courage to stand up and say, enough is enough. Take your loot and split and get out of here. Ron Paul being perhaps the only exception right now.
I agree with you.
All right, we got another caller waiting on the line, Andrea in Oklahoma. Aloha, Andrea. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Yes, I have a question, and it's basically about these insurance companies that insure the mortgage titles. And the second question is, look into your crystal ball. How in the world is any American ever going to trust the government on anything with buying a home or ever wanting to buy a home, because it's never going to be truly ours? You always feel as though somebody can pull it out from underneath you. That's my question. I'll listen. Thank you.
Well, it's interesting. The mortgage insurers really have a lot of control, because when a person defaults on the mortgage or the bank makes a claim against the mortgage insurer and gets paid. And the mortgage insurer is really what mucks things up, because, I mean, in a perfect world, the homeowner should be able to do a deed in lieu or something to walk away from the property if it's going to be more of a burden. But it's the mortgage insurer that holds everyone's feet to the fire and requires a deficiency agreement so they get their money paid back. So that's the problem. And you saw with the program from Obama, it was an adjunct to the HAMP modification. It said is if you qualify under HAMP and you want to short sale your house, you can't get hit with a deficiency. The exception to the rule is that there is a mortgage insurer, and the mortgage insurer can still require the deficiency. So that's a problem, and it plays into the second half of the question. Can we trust the government? The answer is no.
No, the answer should have been no going all the way back to, well, certainly our lifetime. The government has never behaved in a manner that we should trust them whatsoever, but we're not for the media saying, oh, they're really a swell bunch of Joes out there. But, you know, getting into this issue of the insurance, I mean, we're getting to this thing about the credit default swaps. We have seen so many abuses of financial institutions that knowingly sold investments that were not going to work, because they expected to make the money back on these credit default swaps, the derivatives. Classic example would be Goldman Sachs, that was paid by the state of California to sell California bonds, and at the same time they were selling these credit default swaps, betting on the bonds to fail, which they ultimately did, and Goldman Sachs made a ton of money, and the Californians took it in the teeth. And it seems like, you know, I'm one of those old-fashioned kind of guys who views the stock market as a means for ordinary Americans to invest in and profit from the productivity of the American industry. And it seems more and more that Wall Street really doesn't care about manufacturing or productivity. It's turned itself into a giant open-air casino with all these derivatives and swaps and these gains. And it's almost like they're too busy, you know, running the money around in circles to be bothered with actually making products anymore. There's this wonderful quote from the movie Wall Street 2, Money Never Sleeps, where Gordon Gekko's out there saying, and I know that Oliver Stone went out and researched this very well, 40% of America's corporate profits last year came from the financial services industry, money made on money, not money making furniture or cars or computers or TVs or growing food or any of that stuff. 40% of the corporate profits in this country came from playing around with other people's money.
And that's a sad statement on the state of America, because we used to be a manufacturing nation. We used to make things. And that's when this country was good. That's when this country was admired by foreign countries. Now it's all about greed.
It really is. And, you know, there's this saying in Japan that you cannot make money by just shaking it back and forth from side to side. And yet that seems to be, you know, what Wall Street thinks, you know, is the magic. We used to make products to make money. Now we've made money the product, and we take money and we bundle it up and we wrap it in paper and put a ribbon on it and sparkly little decorations, and we shuffle it around and say, this is what the businesses of America is all about, is repackaging money and repackaging debt. And in an economy that continues to grow, i.e. plunge further and further and deeper into debt to the Federal Reserve, these games could kind of work for a while. But when you've lost your manufacturing, and, you know, you need to remember that work precedes capital. There's no new money coming into the system from the sale of products to other countries. Sooner or later, that whole pyramid has to come crashing down. And it is. The music has stopped. Everybody's scrambling for a chair. And I think you and I are in agreement that it is the goal of Wall Street and Washington, D.C., that the American people are the ones left standing without a chair when the dust settles.
That is unfortunately the truth. I mean, this country needs to get back to the basics. Let's make things. Let's innovate things. Let's lead the world. But, just selling and repackaging debt, it has an ultimate conclusion, and it's not good for the American people.
No, it isn't. And I remember when I was a kid, you know, we looked up with respect at people who knew how to make things, build things, fix them, keep them working. And I look around today in our society, and it's almost like we worship people who get money, no matter how they get it. And we look on those who actually have tools in their hands as some kind of a lower social order. Like, ooh, we don't want to be them. He's holding a screwdriver. Oh, he must be lower class. And I think that's a very, very dangerous situation. I mean, I think the people who can build things and make things and keep them running, that we should accord them a high degree of respect, because that's what the nation is dependent on. And you look around in our conditions about our roads and our infrastructure, and everything's falling apart because nobody wants to be seen, working on a road or a bridge or a rail line. That's so lower class. You know, if you want to be held to high esteem in our popular media, you got to be up there in a three-piece suit and, you know, a gold wristwatch and, you know, running deals and arbitrage and all the rest of it. We've got a very, very twisted set of social values. We got to take a break here right now for commercials, and I know our commercial breaks are a little bit. I hope you can stay with us a little bit longer because we've got a couple of callers waiting on the line. So when we come back from this break, we'll be talking with Harley in Indiana about banks and mortgages, and then Mark in California has a question about his mortgage. We'll be right back.
When all this twist is sealed, what's swept away? Did these remaining holes reveal what's really?
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show. And if you were hoping that this Massachusetts Supreme Court decision was going to make the corporate news, no such luck. Just in time to save the banks. We're getting a breaking story about an exploding envelope in a Washington, D.C. postal facility. And they're already equating it to the anthrax attacks after 9/11, which we know involved anthrax from U.S. military lab at Fort Detrick. So this is another hoax, and it's another distraction. It's probably following on those explosive packages in Maryland. It looks like the U.S. government's getting ready to do another big phony terror attack to take all of our attention off the way they've creamed the economy and screwed up the wars and basically just screwed up the nation as a whole. I can't think of anything the U.S. government has actually done right in the last 10 years. We've lost our space program. We've lost our manufacturing. Our country is crumbling right before our very eyes. And it just seems to be getting more and more out of control. Tracy, we've got a couple of callers on the line, and let's try and get to them before the top of the hour. Harley, rented lips. Harley in Indiana, aloha. What is your question?
My question is, does not the bank fail, you know, the mortgage mess, does not that fulfill the planks of the Communist Manifesto of abolition of all private property and also the Illuminati, you know, Adam Weishaupt's program from 1776 to confiscate all private property and put it in the hands of the government, ultimately the banks? And, of course, we know the banks once again financed the revolution over into communism.
Well, I don't think we need to ascribe this to a communist plot. I think it's just simple greed explains everything.
No, we're talking about the plot that has been involved for over 200 years to confiscate private property.
Okay, Harley, thank you, Harley. We're going to let you go because that is not germane to our present discussion. I think what has afflicted our nation, pure and simple, is greed. We don't need to look any further than that. We don't need to look any further than Washington, D.C. and the halls of Congress and Wall Street. I'm not going to let it get dragged off looking for some mythical, non-existent Illuminati conspiracy that we can never find. The buck stops in Washington and Wall Street. Greed and money addiction to the point of social collapse is all that we need to look at right now. And I'm sorry to cut you off, but I was kind of expecting somebody to come in and try and take us off topic and say, way off in the mists of unreachable foreign lands, blah, 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 blah. Mark in California, real quick, what's on your mind?
I have a second on my condo, and I'm underwater because of it, and I'm wondering, is there any way for me to get out from under it without going through just a default, a basic default or a bankruptcy?
Well, the best option for you is a bankruptcy, a Chapter 13 reorganization. The way the bankruptcy courts are treating it right now is they will strip away the second mortgages and they'll use their inherent power to reduce the primary mortgage down to the market value. So that is the best option for you. And it helps if you have other debt that you can resolve through the bankruptcy also.
Is the bank going to be eager to do that with me because of the situation Mike's describing with the needs of the assets on their balance sheet?
Of course they're not going to be eager to do that. But if you go, you have to realize when you're in a foreclosure or pre-foreclosure, the banks have all the bargaining power. When you go to the bankruptcy court, the debtor and the homeowner has the bargaining power.
I see. So I shouldn't wait until things get worse.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, listen, we're coming up to the top of the hour here. And, Tracy, I cannot tell you how glad I am that you were able to call in today. And I'm hoping that maybe we can have you back maybe in just another week, middle of next week, end of next week, because this story is not going to go away. I'm certainly going to keep my focus on it. This Massachusetts Supreme Court decision has just sent shockwaves through the financial system. I think that's why we're seeing a media distraction right now. So, Tracy, thank you. Anything you want to say in the last few seconds?
I'm available to anyone who needs any type of advice. And, Mike, I'm certainly available to you as a resource anytime you need it.
All right. Well, thanks an awful lot. And email me your contact information. I'll post it at What Really Happened. We'll be right back.
Tonight.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to show. Welcome back to hour number two here. And my goodness, we have a lot of viewers on Justin TV today. And we're at 484 right now, which is, I think, a new personal best record here. There is a lot of stuff going on, and I'm not able to find any details about this story about they're calling it an envelope rather than a package, ignited into flames in a Washington, D.C. Postal facility. So for everybody who was saying that the packages down at Annapolis were a lone nut unhappy with highway signs, maybe not. This looks like basically a buildup to a new staged heightened terror booga booga scare by the U.S. government to keep everybody's mind distracted from the absolute disaster unfolding economically. And that's not just the Massachusetts State Supreme Court decision regarding foreclosures. And basically, they just invalidated pretty much every foreclosure in process in Massachusetts that involved the mortgage electronic registration system. And it sets a legal precedent for the entire rest of the country. Because, as Tracy was saying, in order to foreclose, you must have the mortgage and the note. And they become separated as part of the securitization process. And so virtually every mortgage that became part of a mortgage-backed security is now legally impossible to foreclose on. And we're going to see some very draconian actions by the federal government to protect the banks, which will provoke a constitutional crisis, which may in turn provoke a revolution, as what happened over in Iceland. And I hope the American people will wake up for this, and I think this situation about another booga booga in Washington, D.C. is very clearly an effort by the government to keep your focus off of the economy. Now, we're seeing, you know, spike in unemployment numbers. It makes sense. We're through the holiday shopping rush. Stores are completing their inventory counts for inventory tax. They're letting the temporary retail workers go. They're all going out and filing for unemployment. And it's not just the temporary. If you've been watching whatreallyhappened.com, we are posting all these stories about how these retail chains are shutting down outlets. In some cases, they're going out of business completely. The holiday shopping season represents one-third of the profitability of most retail operations, and a lot of these stores were just hanging on to the end of the year, hoping that they could do a good enough business in Christmas to survive into 2011, and they came up short. The numbers are coming in. It was a disastrous shopping season. We knew that Christmas Day when we were walking around and looking at the wrapping paper, or the absence thereof, in the trash bins around here. we knew it was an absolute complete disaster. And we're seeing, you know, store after store, chain after chain, going out of business. All those people are losing their jobs. In the coming weeks, between now and the 1st of February, we're going to see unemployment explode. The government is openly admitting the figures they're putting out now have been revised and seasonally adjusted, which is government speak for we're lying through our nose to hide the truth from you. Why does the government have to revise or adjust the unemployment numbers? Take how many people there are in the United States, subtract out how many people have got jobs, that's your unemployment number. But it's a huge, huge number. Our estimates are we're up to one-third unemployment. That's above the level of the Great Depression of 1929. And the government is trying to keep that number down. They're lying to you. That's basically, they're going to lie, distract, disinform, and try and get you focused over to someplace else. So we've got this booga booga over in Washington, D.C. And that's all it is. Whatever it happened, it's the government's attempt to manage public perceptions and manage the media. Remember the bombing in Beirut that killed all those Marines? And 24 hours later, we invade Grenada. Change the focus. Change the story. That's what's going on in Washington, D.C., and we'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
What this country is coming to, I sure would like to know. If they don't do something by and by, the rich will live and the poor will die. Doggone, I mean the panic is on.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show. We're starting to get some information coming in from this Washington, D.C. situation. They're calling it an envelope. It didn't explode. It just kind of started on fire. And nobody was hurt. It's really kind of a non-story, but this gives the media the perfect excuse to not give any coverage at all to this morning's landmark, precedent-setting Massachusetts State Supreme Court ruling, which ruled that mortgages cannot be foreclosed on if the mortgage and note have become separated and proper title has not been conveyed. The notes can be basically endorsed in blank and passed around like so much, you know, paper money in a Monopoly game. But the mortgages have to be explicitly transferred, and there's a tax fee involved in that. And one of the aspects of this whole mortgage electronic reservation system is that the states got shortchanged billions and billions of dollars in title transfer fees they were otherwise owed. So this whole system is about tax evasion. All righty, we got a caller waiting on the line, Robert, New York. Aloha, Robert. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Okay, what I wanted to ask you about, how much more do you know about the Wheeler case? John Wheeler?
Well, what I am hearing through my contacts is he was a very straight-up guy. He did not drink. He was a West Point graduate. Class
yes,
of 66.
I know about that.
Okay.
Yes.
Very much.
But he's had something to do with the Clarksdale thing with the missing hydrogen bomb? Huh?
Those
nukes that were sent across?
Well, no, because what I have heard is that the police investigation at his home showed that he had been tied to a chair in his own kitchen. The video of him wandering around looking dazed suggests that he was drugged. But apparently the floor of his kitchen was torn up. So, this the motive for this could lie in any of many directions. He was an insider aide to Presidents Reagan and Bush. Apparently he had some information to protect himself. Somebody decided it was time for that information to go away. Was he related to this missing nuke situation? That's a little bit of a reach. Certainly this article that's going around the internet claiming that he was involved in the mass animal die-offs, that's complete nonsense. Somebody's trying to obfuscate the situation there. I think it's another William Colby situation. The guy had inside information. The person that the information could damage did not trust him to stay silent, and had him tortured to find the information and then gotten rid of. I think it's William Colby all over again. What I'm hearing from the people that I know who knew him, very stand-up guy, just did it all, was very straight, very much dedicated to the country. So, yeah, that's what's going on with there. All righty, moving on. We've talked about the economy enough, and I don't intend to give any more attention to this, envelopes on fire in Washington, D.C., to give the media an excuse not to report on what affects all of your lives. Remember Rivero's rule of the news. News is what affects your life, your prosperity, your health, your future. That is news. Anything else is fluff. It's distraction. You know, Oprah Winfrey got a new network. That doesn't affect you. You know, Lindsay Lohan has to go back to rehab. That doesn't affect you either. Even this envelope on fire in a Washington, D.C. post office, if you don't work at that post office, it doesn't affect you. The Massachusetts State Supreme Court ruling against the banks on the fraud closures, that affects every single American. Because whether you've got a foreclosure or not, the financial fallout from this scandal affects us all. $16 trillion and counting poured into Wall Street to get them off the hook for the mortgage-backed securities. Get out your calculator and divide that by 300 million Americans, and you will see how much this scandal affects your life. Okay, going to go to the phones. Kurt in Oregon, aloha. Kurt, welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Yeah, you're talking about media management. And I don't think they have to do anything with the mega media, because they're fully cooperative with the government, because they always want access and they always want favors and broadcast spectrum and all that. But I want to talk about the
Mockingbird. You've got Mockingbird. You've got Israel bribing the corporate media millions and millions of dollars. I mean, the corporate media, that's why we call them prostitutes. They're not really.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, what I wanted to say was about the management of perception of the American people. And the one thing that really triggered my call when you mentioned that is this neologism they're using on the American people, and they've been using for a year, of quantitative easing. All the media repeats it like a bunch of parrots, and no one will come out and say the obvious thing. It's currency debasement, and no one will say that.
That's exactly what it is. You know,
exactly. And they're conning the American people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're always using these funny little expressions to try and confuse what's really going on. It's like I talk about all the time. They talk about the growth of the economy, and we all think, oh, growth is a good thing, isn't it? Yeah, well, no, because what they mean under the Federal Reserve System, the growth of the economy means an increase in the total indebtedness of the American people. It's, you know, growing the economy means putting more slave chains on our future generations. For the bankers, yeah, that's a good thing. But for the American people, no, it isn't. Because under our banking system... What?
As long as they're going to use all these neologisms and euphemisms, the American people are never going to be able to make a straight thinking and a straight conclusion so they can have a coherent policy. They're going to keep clouding the thinking of the American people, and it's only shows like yours and a few other Internet shows where people are going to call a spade a spade, and I bet you are one of the few that will call it currency debasement.
Oh, yeah, I call it hyperinflation, but it basically comes down to the same thing. And absolutely, when you have a printing press-based economy, the money is debased over time because it's profitable for the banks and politicians to debase, the money. I mean, look at the value of the dollar since the creation of the Federal Reserve. The dollar has lost 96% of its value to debasement. Now the debasement is accelerating. It's an old problem, but at a new increased warp drive rate.
Yep. And one thing you can add to your predictions for the year 2011 is much higher food prices.
Oh, already. We're already seeing it. And it's not just because of hyperinflation and debasement. All the bumper crops that were supposed to create an ample supply to get into the markets, they're all freezing right now. All across the United States, all across Europe, bumper crops in the farms are being destroyed by the cold. They're trying to run the smudge pots and everything to keep the crops from freezing until they can be harvested, and it's not working. So we're going to have major food shortages, and that, of course, will drive up prices even more.
Yeah, well, thanks for the program.
All right, thanks an awful lot. We're going to switch over to Ruth in Illinois. Aloha, Ruth. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
I'm sorry to have missed the topic. I wanted to make a comment on John Wheeler and his recent demise.
Mm-hmm.
If you note, he was seen in the DuPont building in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, part of the DuPont building has been converted into luxury apartments. Some of the DuPonts may actually live there now. But he wrote the manual on chemical and biological warfare. That was his expertise. And
He was involved in a lot of stuff. He knows where a lot of the skeletons are buried and how they got to be skeletons.
Well, weren't the DuPonts involved with chemical and biological warfare in Vietnam?
They were the manufacturers of napalm, and I believe also Agent Orange, which was actually tested out here in Hawaii at the University of Hawaii at Manoa.
Right. So there's something that that situation is so hot the FBI won't even touch it.
Well, that alone tells you right there it's another William Colby situation. And I'm sure we're going to get a lot.
Is being run by Bo Biden, Vice President Biden's son.
Okay, well, that tells us a lot about what's going on there. Like I said, it's another William Colby situation. Wheeler had something that was damning of you know somebody else in power, and he was a liability, and now he's gone. And and it's tragic, and we'll keep an eye on it, but I don't think it's as important a story as what's going on with the fraudulent foreclosures in the economy and the very obvious panic, knee-jerk attempt by the U.S. government to create a media distraction.
Well, I'm concerned because of his expertise in chemical and biological warfare.
I rather doubt that was the motive. Again, going back to the initial police report that the floor of his kitchen had been torn up, I think he had information that he was using to keep himself safe. And, it's like Vincent Foster had an envelope in his office safe at the White House that was supposed to be turned over to the Department of Justice if anything unfortunate happened to him. His big mistake was putting it inside the White House because the night of his suiciding, there was a technical team from the Army that came in that was expert at opening safes. And they got into his office and cleaned out the safe before the Park Police even showed up for the investigation. So the problem with the dead man switch is if your enemy finds it, then you're gone. That's the problem with that. All right,
thank
so I'm going
to and I like your program.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the phone call and the kind words here. Now, over in the European Union, as you know, there have been riots, there have been firebombings, there have been attacks on top government officials. Over in Iceland, they kicked out the government. They went into the government buildings and said, "You are fired. You have screwed the pooch for the last time. Get out. Get your resumes, leave the office supplies behind and get out of our government buildings." Well, guess what, folks? Apparently, the governments in Europe are getting the message. The European Union is getting ready to pass laws to make sure that the taxpayers do not have to bail out the banks from now on. Rioting works. Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Some are maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, distract yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. And before the break, I was talking about how the European Union is now getting ready to pass laws that will protect ordinary taxpayers from having to pick up the tab for the bank bailouts. A little late. They're shutting the barn door and the horse is already gone. Certainly would have been nice to have had something like that here in the United States of America. And the lesson to be learned is that civil unrest of screaming to the government, "We didn't create this mess and we're not going to pay for it," does appear to be working to some extent. And obviously our government, which absolutely is convinced that you should be made to pay for the bank's excesses, because after all, they deserve those $100,000 wristwatches and $150 hamburgers, they're getting ready to deal with civil unrest in this country. It is coming. Everybody knows it. Anybody who doesn't think it's going to happen is delusional. The Pentagon and the military are actively wargaming large-scale economic breakdown and civil unrest. I don't know why they're wasting their time. The government's already perfect at large-scale economic breakdown. Look around. The economy's breaking down. The government did it on a large scale. I don't think the military needs to worry about that anymore. As far as civil unrest, I think the American people really do have a good instinct for that sort of thing, going back to 1776. And, of course, I'm joking here, but what's going on is the U.S. military is getting ready to be basically come in and treat the American people the way the Nazis treated the Germans. You know, you will pay the government. You will give the money to your bank, you Schweinhund. Get to the airport. We're going to strip you naked and so forth and so on, all the rest of this stuff. Let's see. Somebody actually sent me something that I do need to read to you. It came in here. Let's see if I can find it again. Okay. I've had so much mail come in, I've lost track of it. It was a humorous thing about the Tourism Suppression Agency, and I've already lost it. I'll have to post it at whatreallyhappened.com. Now, Ben Bernanke, of course, taking a break out from his very, very hard work running those printing presses to debase the American currency, is out there making, you know, these speeches about how the U.S. debt is out of control and nobody gives a darn. And the quote from him saying, it is widely understood that the federal government is on an unsustainable fiscal path. Well, we knew that. I've been telling you that for years. And Bernanke goes on, as a nation, we have done little to address this critical threat to our economy. Now, there's the giveaway when he says, as a nation. He says, the government is on an unsustainable path, but the nation has to address the critical threat. In other words, the government made the mess, but you, the people, get to pay for it. That's Bernanke's agenda. That's what he said. The government is on an unsustainable fiscal path. As a nation, we have to address the critical threat. When he says nation, he means you, the people. You, the taxpayer. He's not going to pay for the mess. The government's not going to pay for the mess. The government doesn't have any money. Now, as a nation, we did not create this crisis. The government created the crisis without our permission, in large part before most of us were old enough to vote or even before we were born. This mess goes back to 1913, when a bunch of greedy money addicts in the banks came in and made a deal with the greedy money addicts in Congress and a greedy money addict president who was desperate for that Oval Office and willing to do anything to get it, which is the usual trend, I might add. And they sold us all into debt slavery to a private central bank. And all of this took place before we were born. And yet from birth, we are told, this is the way it's supposed to be, and you will work your entire life away to keep this private central bank in business. Because that's just the way it's supposed to be. And there is no other way to do it, which we all know is wrong. Because this is not the way it was set up when the country was created. So the government created that debt without our permission. In my opinion, we should not be obligated to pay debts we had no choice in making. Especially in a government that is scandalized repeatedly by massive vote fraud. We don't even know if these bozos handing out the money really are the government at this point. They can't prove it. They can't document that they are the lawful government at this point. That's how out of control it is. Now, I got some email from people saying, well, you know, the way the country is operated is you vote these representatives, and then once they're in power, you must do whatever they say. Because that's just the way the government works. No. The key is representative. The members of the Congress are voted by the people to represent them in Washington, D.C. Their job is not to issue orders, but to obey them. That's what the word representative government means, as in House of Representatives. If we, the people, tell our representatives not to vote TARP, the only way the representatives are representing the people is to not vote TARP. When Congress turns around and defies the will of the people to vote to save their own investment portfolios on the backs of the taxpayer, they cease being representative of the people. They're no longer representatives. And that puts us in a situation of taxation without representation. And in that little tiny schoolhouse in New Hampshire, where I learned social studies, I was taught that taxation without representation, a government that takes your money and doesn't listen to what you want, is grounds for firing the government, which we did back in 1776. All right, we've got to take another break. We'll be back. Join us on the air, 800-313-9443.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Visit us online at whatreallyhappened.com. And now, set your eyes on the future and let's consider what really happened.
Here, and we're going to move off the topic of the economy. We'll certainly be back on it next week without any question, without any question whatsoever. We're going to be staying on this topic. We're going to be staying on the topic of the Massachusetts Supreme Court decision. The ramifications are far-reaching. I don't know them all. Tracy was able to fill in a few of the gaps, and I'm sure there's a lot of other implications that we still don't fully understand. We do know that when this court decision came down, the stocks of the involved banks took a major hit. So the perception out there is this is really, really bad news for the fraud closure people, as it should be. And I don't think financial penalties are enough. I think these people should be in jail for what they have done, or worse. All right, but we're going to switch over here to some of the news here. Now, over in Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu has now formally petitioned the United States government for the release of convicted Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard. And it's rather amazing to look at the servile media who are trying to build a case to convince America that this guy has suffered enough for what he did and should be allowed to go home. Because after all, he was spying for a friendly country. That really makes, there is really no big deal. He's spying for a friendly country. He's spying for Israel. And well, actually, if you read the letter of the law for espionage, you will find out there is no distinction made whether you're spying for a friendly country or a not friendly country. And the part of the Jonathan Pollard story that is missing from these interviews, like the one this lady Glick is going around, she's on the media saying, oh, really, it's not that big a deal. It was just Israel. Like, you know, they should be entitled to our secrets anyway, which is a very common and dangerous attitude. But I'll tell you why it's not okay for Jonathan Pollard to have spied for Israel. Because let me give you a little background on the case. Jonathan Pollard took it upon himself to sell classified documents about America's nuclear deterrent to Israel. Now, in court, he said his justification was he felt Israel should have them anyway. But you know something? That wasn't his call to make. It's a little bit above his pay grade. But that was his justification. Now, Israel took those same documents and they bartered them to the Union of Soviet Socialists Republic in exchange for an increase in emigration quotas to allow more Russian Jews to come to Israel. Now, our parents, my parents, that generation, were taxed $5 trillion. And that's back when a trillion was a lot of money, to build and maintain America's nuclear deterrent. All the little submarines, all the bombers, all the missiles, all the silos, all of that stuff. Fail safes, the little keys, all of it was built on the justification of deterring a potential attack by the USSR. What Jonathan Pollard did was he handed to Israel, who handled to the Soviet Union, the ready means to bypass that deterrent. That is the scale of this treason that happened. Now, when Julius and Ethel Rosenberg transferred America's nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union, they got the death penalty. They got put in the electric chair. Ethel twice, because they botched the first one. And it was recognized how much damage to America's security had been carried out by the Rosenbergs. Now you've got Jonathan Pollard, who has essentially done the same thing. He handed Israel, who handed the USSR, the means to completely bypass America's nuclear deterrent. Had Russia decided to attack the United States, they would have won. And we have Israel's shills are all over the net right now saying it's no big deal when Israel spies steal stuff for Israel because it's harmless. No, it isn't. It's very harmful. And the American people who will classify these documents, if they said, you know, I don't think Israel should have this, okay, then Israel shouldn't have it. And Israel's assets and shills inside the United States do not have an inherent automatic right to override that decision process. Jonathan Pollard does not have the right to decide that Israel needs to see these documents. That's not Jonathan Pollard's decision to make, and it's not Israel's decision to make, and it's not Israel's right to retroactively excuse a treason on such a scale. Because after all, we're all good buddies and we're all good friends if you ignore the fact that Israel was shooting at Americans in international waters last May. So now we're seeing this whole thing about how this Israel spy request is straining relations with the United States. Israel's relations with the United States are strained coming out of that whole thing about those pesky West Bank settlements and Obama's decision to maybe not send the second batch of freebie F-35 warplanes to Israel. And that's straining our relations. And this confusion over Jonathan Pollard is straining Israeli relations. Okay, in my opinion, too bad. Why are we so worried about strained relations with Israel? I mean, if I had been president last May, I would have cut all relations with Israel the way Turkey did after they hijacked that U.S. flagship, kidnapped U.S. citizens, and murdered that one 19-year-old kid from New York in international waters. I would have terminated diplomatic relations with Israel the way Turkey did. I would have thrown Israel's ambassador in jail at that point. That was an act of war committed by Israel against Americans in international waters, and our government didn't do anything about it. So why, after such insults, after the USS Liberty, after being scammed and tricked with Levant affair and smuggled transmitters into Libya, and all the money that the American taxpayer has been forced to give to Israel, four times the entire cost of the Apollo moon program, why are we worried about relations with Israel? What has Israel done for us that we should be so worried about upsetting them? As far as I'm concerned, you know, Israel has gotten enough from the United States of America. If they don't want to be friends with the United States of America anymore, good! Let them go! Who needs them? What have they done for the United States of any benefit whatsoever other than to cause more trouble for us? The hatred that is directed against America by the rest of the world, the loss of respect, the loss of moral standing in the world, is because we constantly, unquestioningly back Israel's agenda of stealing other people's land. It's time to stop throwing good money after bad. It is time to stop being a pussy. If Israel wants to throw a tantrum and say, give us our spy or we're not going to be your friends anymore, I'm going to say, fine, go. No more checks, no more weapons, no more support. You don't get to call the shots on our nuclear deterrent. We're cutting the wires. Here's your ambassador back. Go. Take care of yourself from now on. We've had enough. We've had 60 years of supporting Israel. I think they're old enough to leave the nest and make their way through the world on their own two feet or not. We have got problems in this country, including a Wall Street that even Alan Greenspan admits is criminal and fraudulent. We've got to take care of the United States first, and to heck with Israel. America needs leaders who are going to put America first, second, and third. No government can serve two masters. And a friend of Israel is not a friend of the United States of America. So too darn bad that Israel is upset. We're not going to give them back their spy that allowed them to give to the USSR America's top nuclear deterrent secrets. Too bad. Who needs them? Who needs Israel as a friend right now? What good do they do the United States of America? And by the way, they make really crappy batteries, too. And that's not anti-Semitism or racism, it's technology. All righty, moving right along here. Let's see. All right, we're gonna pound on the global warming people here a little bit. As you know, over the last several years, back to 1998, according to Phil Jones of Hadley CRU, the Earth has actually gone into a cooling trend, especially these last three winters, which are brutal. And guess what? Apparently, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been going up all along. Carbon dioxide up, temperature down, which just destroys, completely undermines this claimed correlation between carbon dioxide and global warming. It does reinforce the correlation between global temperature and the activity of the sun, which we know has been there all along, going back to the Maunder minimum. But the latest data is basically confirming there is no demonstrable link between carbon dioxide and global warming. In the graph that Al Gore shows in his documentary, Ha Ha, Nudge Nudge, Wink Wink, showing a correlation between carbon dioxide and global warming, he actually has the relationship backward, because if you go in close enough to the detail, you will see that warming goes up first. Then you get increased carbon dioxide, which makes perfect sense. Warmer temperatures, more life, more food, more biological activity, more animals producing carbon dioxide. Al Gore tries to make it look like it's the other way. Carbon dioxide goes up and then the Earth gets warmer. That's not what the data shows when you look at it closely. He's lying to you. He's a politician. That's what he does. Okay, let's see. I think we already talked about the Freedom of Information Act over at Virginia. One of their lights of global warming is in serious legal trouble for fraud. Now, I want to talk about this brouhaha over the bird and fish deaths. It's one of those things that the media has taken, and they're fanning it up to make it an issue, again, as a distraction. They don't want you looking at the news that actually affects you, like the economy, the unemployment, the foreclosure scandal, the mortgage-backed securities fraud, the endless corruption of Wall Street and Washington, D.C. Oh, look at the birds dying over here. Look at the fish dying. Look at all this other stuff. And don't equate that with hypothermia. Oh, no, 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 it's weird stuff. It's chemtrails, and it's HARP, and it's UFOs, and it's Elvis, and it's all this other stuff. And I, just before we went to airtime, I put up a story about a massive, massive bird die-off in Austin, and it's the exact same stuff we've been reading the last couple of days, except, of course, this one happened back in 2007, which is my way of underscoring these things actually happen all the time, but nobody pays attention. It's not a big deal until the media and the propagandists and the global warming cultists all say, ooh, this is something you should be paying attention to. Okay, now they had some doves die over in Italy, and they're saying, there's a strange blue stain on their beaks. Come on, guys, blue, cyan, cyanide. Not everybody is as humane in trying to keep the birds from pooping all over your buildings. I know here in the United States of America, we put up these little wire spiky things so the birds, when they land, will impale themselves and bleed to death. But in other countries, they will put out poison bait to kill the birds. And it's hardly anything new about that. Tom Lehrer wrote a song about it, which we've got linked to the front page of whatreallyhappened.com, Poisoning Pigeons in the Park, which is a hilarious, kind of funny song. But it does, you know, we laugh at it because we understand that, yeah, some people just get off on doing that kind of stuff. And so that blue stain on the beak tells us that more than likely, you know, they were fed some cyanide tainted feed in order to keep them from reproducing and pooing all over the buildings and stuff. So it's no big mystery and it's no big deal. But the reason it's become one is because the global warming cultists want to obliterate the link between all these dead birds and fish and hypothermia. In other words, they died of the extreme cold, because that's not a linkage they want going into next summer when they're going to try once again to sell you this carbon tax and this global government. So they're out there screaming HARP and chemtrails and shifting Earth magnetic fields and weapons tests and anything to basically make it an issue to keep you paying attention over here instead of paying attention to the fact that we're in one of the harshest cold winters we've ever seen in our lifetime. This is the coldest winter we've ever seen in our lifetimes, right now in front of us, and it completely undermines this whole global warming situation. And we're starting to see, again, they're screaming about, you know, democracy is bad for planet Earth. We've got to have a global fascist dictatorship, or you're all going to die from global warming. Now, there's a video that we've linked to the front page of whatreallyhappened.com, and it's kind of funny in a very sick, twisted, kind of tragic sense. And basically, somebody took these two schoolgirls down to the border control fence that we have with Mexico. And this fence costs the U.S. taxpayer $4 million per mile. And they take these two girls and they say, climb over the fence. And they reach the top in 18 seconds. because the way the fence is designed makes it easy to climb. This is the most brain-dead thing I've ever seen in my life. This $4 million a mile fence, and it's designed in a way that makes it easy as pie to climb up and over. And these two girls do it on their first try, 18 seconds to the top. And it's just another example of all the money that is spent by the government to accomplish a stated goal, and then you find out the goal, they're not interested in the goal. Interested in the goal. Rented lips. So we're spending millions of dollars on border control that does not work. We're spending millions of dollars on a minerals management service that's accepting, sex favors from the oil company to look the other way as they destroy the Gulf of Mexico. We're paying millions of dollars to support the Securities and Exchange Commission that looked the other way for 12 years while Bernie Madoff ripped off his own investors, and on and on and on. And remember, everything that's going on with this fraud closure situation, the U.S. government was supposed to be keeping an eye on that, and they didn't. And now it's becoming more and more obvious that the U.S. government's solution to the reckless mortgage-backed security fraud, instead of jailing the people who committed the fraud and suing the banks who made all that money off of that, is to turn around and find a way to let the banks grab your homes to recapitalize with, to cover the losses. Now, is this the kind of behavior you want from people that you voted into office and pay taxes to? I don't think so. And it gets back to that whole situation. We have taxation without representation. They're charging us taxes, and taxes are going up again. Huge tax increases all across the board, state and local level. Taxes are going up, and they're not listening to you. You're considered walking wallets. You're only good to provide money and new soldiers, and other than that, they really don't care about you. All righty. Another one from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They're redefining what organic means. Now, you and I, when we think of organic on a food label, we think something grown on a farm with organic fertilizers and, you know, organic, you know, real natural organic components. And apparently the USDA is now redefining organic because the big food manufacturers understand that the American people want to get away from chemicals and synthetic food, and they want to buy organic. So now they've gone to the government to get the USDA to change the legal definition of organic so they can take the same crud, chemical-laden, synthetic stuff they've been selling you for the last couple of years and put organic label on it. Contains organic components or organic... what they're trying to weasel word the way to convince you to buy their product. We'll be right back.
When all this twists was swept away, did these remaining holes reveal what really happened?
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show. We're getting some more details about that DC flaming envelope. And apparently it was addressed to the Homeland Security Secretary Napolitano. Talk about a pathetic bid for sympathy in the aftermath of this public outcry and anger and rage against the Transportation Safety Administration and these plans to put TSA fondle booths in bus stations and shopping malls and the rest of it. So what does Napolitano do? Oh, feel bad for me. The bad people hate me. They're sending me exploding envelopes. I'm sorry. I'm not going to fall for it. And I don't feel sorry for you. It's a hoax. It is an obvious, pathetic hoax to try and play victim in sympathy when you're out there causing all the damage. We're hanging around with the Israelis way too much over there in Washington, D.C. They think the stuff that'll work in Israel will work here, and it's not going to. Now, getting back to the situation about a government that absolutely has abandoned any, even the pretense of trying to protect the American people from anything, you have probably seen these commercials all over the TV for the Power Balance wristband where this California company has this little plastic rubber. I'm not even really sure. I haven't paid that much attention to them. But they put it on you, and then they do this demonstration where when you don't have the wristband, you can be pulled off your feet. And when you do have the wristband, you are much more stable. And by the way, this is an old, old, old magic trick that they're doing. relative to physiology and dynamics, and it's been used for all kinds of hoaxes. It goes back hundreds of years. This little simple stunt of how it's how they pull you determines whether you're going to go off your feet or not. So apparently down in Australia, they sued the company for false representation, and as part of the settlement, they got this company in California to admit there is absolutely no scientific basis behind these claims about this power balance wristband. And they got him to admit it down in Australia. Here in the United States, it's still perfectly legal for them to go on showing these commercials and saying, yes, there's science and there's tech and there's health and there's all this other stuff. And these wristbands, you know, will make you taller and slimmer and sexier. And, you know, you will win the lotteries if you wear these things, whatever else is they're saying. We're in the snake oil phase of the nation's history. We're being peddled all these scams by corporations, by the government, and by the media, and nobody is watching out for you except, of course, the blogs and the alternative media. And the audience is coming over here, and, you know, it shows they're losing advertising revenues. In fact, last thing for the show today, Howard Stern had his contract renegotiated over at Sirius XM Radio, and he's had to take a pay cut. It's hard economic times. He's had to take a pay cut. His new salary is down from $100 million a year to only $80 million a year. And we all feel bad for Howard Stern. And as a note to my fellow RBN hosts, you got a lot of room in negotiating your salaries right now. $80 million a year. My goodness, I wouldn't even know what to do with that kind of money. But I'm willing to learn. Let's see. Well, we're pretty much to the end of the show here. The only one I want to mention before we hear the final music. 13-year-old girl did something very stupid, walked across the middle of a street, in the middle of the block, got hit. She's in a coma. The police give her a ticket for jaywalking. Talk about sensitivity. That's it for our show. We'll be back Monday at 2 o'clock Central here on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Have a good weekend. Stay safe. Stay well. Watch out for icy roads. And aloha, America.